The future is a hefty responsibility and not one that we take lightly. But then taking things lightly has never been what Hefty is about. That's why we've created the Hefty Renew program that turns hard to recycle plastics into valuable resources like park benches and building materials. To participate, simply fill up an orange Hefty Renew bag with accepted items, tie it up, and drop it in with your regular recycling. That's it. It's that easy. It's time to rethink recycling with Renew. Particular valued resources may vary by geography. More info available at heftyrenew.com.
As humans, we're naturally driven by the search for better. But when it comes to hiring, the best way to search for a candidate isn't to search at all. Don't search, match with Indeed. When I was looking to hire someone, it was so slow and overwhelming. I wish I had used Indeed. If you need to hire, you need Indeed. Indeed is your matching and hiring platform, with over 350 million global monthly visitors according to Indeed data, and a matching engine that helps you find quality candidates fast. Ditch the busy work. Use Indeed for scheduling, screening, and messaging so you can connect with candidates faster. And Indeed doesn't just help you hire faster. 93% of employers agree Indeed delivers the highest quality matches compared to other job sites, according to a recent Indeed survey. And listeners of this show will get a $75 sponsored job credit to get your jobs more visibility at Indeed.com/podcast. That's Indeed.com/podcast. Terms and conditions apply.
Real quick before we start the show, just wanted to let you guys know you can get the show 2 days early by joining our Patreon. Even for a buck, you can listen to the show 2 days early. Go to patreon.com/analogtalk and we got a bunch of stuff over there. Check it out and enjoy the episode.
Hey everybody, welcome back to another episode of Analog Talk, a film photography podcast. I'm your host, Chris.
I'm Tim.
And today on the show, we have Caleb from the Bushwick Darkroom. Hey Caleb.
Hey Chris and Tim, how are ya? Great to be here.
Thanks for joining us. I for one, am super excited to chat with you. Having a community darkroom is like a dream of mine, so I just can't wait to hear all about it. But before we get into that, do you mind giving our listeners a background on you and how you got into photography and what you're up to?
Sure thing. Yeah, so I guess I'm one of those people. Photography is in my blood a little bit. My dad was a photojournalist for 25 years. And I got into it right as he was getting out of it.
Oh, interesting.
After working for a regional daily for that long, he was like, I never want to touch another roll of film again.
Yeah, sure.
That was right when I was getting into the darkroom and stuff. So I guess, I don't know, that was when I was 10 years old. So I kind of decided at age 10, I want to have a technical career in photography.
Wow.
And I made it happen.
Dude, that's amazing.
It's kind of cool. I've been with the darkroom for 7.5 years. I got involved in very early 2013, and it's been amazing to watch it grow and kind of help it transform. The darkroom began in 2011. Lucia Rallo, who's our founder and executive director, started it as a closet in her basement, like a single occupancy darkroom. And then we moved into a half a storefront, and now we're in like a huge warehouse. She can't be here today. She's in the lab up to her neck in film, which we're happy to have that problem.
Yeah, that's a good problem to have when you're that's a good sign too that people are still shooting mm-hmm. during these times.
More than ever.
Wow. So you've been with the darkroom for how long?
Seven years and 4 months.
Damn.
Wow.
Which it flew by. I was a sophomore photography major at NYU when I first kind of found out about it. I was looking for an internship, and I walked in there and got an internship and more. So I'm still still doing the same kind of stuff, and sort of helped it expand from a really fledgling organization to something that is, well, I guess we like to think of ourselves as a forerunner in the analog film lab community world. It's kind of amazing what we built. I still can't be like, man. We did that, but we did.
So when it was a small one room dark room. How did that operation work? I'm assuming everything is completely different now, obviously. Mm-hmm. But were you like renting time out, or was
it was mostly people would rent a couple hours at a time and develop their own film and make prints, and then kind of expanded into offering some classes, like a black and white printing class, crash course, and then into kind of developing film for drop-off customers. We started just doing black and white, and then we started doing color in the tanks. And these days we've got two industrial grade mini lab processors running all the time.
So is it like a membership kind of deal for the dark room, or is it just kind of anybody can pop in deal?
It's a it's a sort of a hybrid structure. So we have members who there's a couple of different membership levels, so they pay for the kind of access that they need, and then they get the key code and 24-hour access to the labs. Most people that use our services, though, aren't members. So anybody can drop off or mail in film. When we're not on lockdown, anybody can walk in and rent the darkroom for an hour here or there. But we have clients from all over the world, and it's really cool to, have people show up and be like, oh yeah, like I'm here visiting from Texas or Canada or wherever, and be like, and this was on my my New York City bucket list.
That's awesome. It's on mine now too.
Yeah, I wanted to visit when I was there last, but it was a quick trip.
Mm-hmm.
So Timothy and I, we've said we're going to go to New York for Lumography Show. So now we have to like have all these landmarks that we want to go to.
We need
like
some extra time now.
The dark room.
All right, well, we'd love to hang out when you're in town.
With the times being the way they are you still working, or are you kind of chilling right now until things kind of, the dust settles?
A little bit of everything. So at the dark room, we are busier than ever. I am out of town for like the next couple of days, taking advantage of an empty vacation house.
Nice.
Ooh.
that I got a lead on. But I'm back in the city soon. But Lucia, who's our executive director, Juliet, who's our operations manager, and some of our lab assistants, Camille and Arthur, are just crushing it with the film development. We're busier than we've ever been. Sometimes it's a little scary when we look at our computer and it says 300 orders in the works, but we're absolutely thrilled about it, and we're kind of rethinking all our workflows to adjust to this new reality. People seem to be really happy that there's a place that they can still get their stuff developed. A lot of our our local competition has been really badly affected by this, and we're sad about that. We're all in this together, and New York City is plenty big enough to sustain however many labs that we've got, probably like at least 7 or 10 that I can think of. There's plenty of film for all of us to work on, so we're glad that we can be kind of a stopgap for people to get their film done during this crisis, but we hope that all of our friends and neighbors in the New York analog world are able to reopen and safely make it through this. The reason that we've been able to continue operating is we're working with just a single person in the lab at a time.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. So we've carved that out as our loophole from Governor Cuomo's rules, but that makes everything a little harder, and certainly it's a lot less fun to be a lab rat when you're all alone in there.
Right. Well, you're doing the good work, that's for sure. I know a lot of us who are kind of going stir crazy, but at least we still get to make photos. So it's great that you guys are still able to provide that service for the community.
Yeah, we are working on and already started putting out an online version of our intro to black and white photography class.
Awesome.
With Keith Marlowe, who is he's an interesting fellow. I would definitely recommend checking out his videos. They're on YouTube and Instagram TV. He was really instrumental in building the current space that we're in now. He he heard that we were moving and expanding, and one day he just showed up and picked up a hammer and a drill.
No kidding. That's awesome.
And he's been there ever since.
Yeah. So do you have what's a normal day? Let's take it back before all this COVID madness happened. What's like a normal day in the life at Bushwick Community Darkroom?
Right. It can vary a lot from day to day. So I have a day job, which is also a fun job. I manage the photo equipment cage at the NYU Tisch Photography Department. So I go do that. I clean dark rooms and boss around undergrads all day.
Yes.
And
then I love it.
And then I come home and have a snack and then go to the dark room. But you know, Lucia is there pretty much 40 to 100 hours a week. So she's, you know, she's really the brains and the brawn behind the operation, and I get to be the pretty face and the technical wizard. But we have a lot of different kinds of programming that's going on. You know, every single day we have film to develop and scans to do. A ton of maintenance goes into just kind of keeping all of these machines running. You'll get a peek into them in the lab tour video I'm going to send you guys.
Yes.
But just the quick list of things that keep me up at night, being like, is it going to break?
Yeah.
Is it going to be okay tomorrow? We've got a Noritsu film processor for color negative. We've got a Noritsu film processor for black and white negative, which is a weird, interesting beast.
Wow.
You know, if you're familiar with lab equipment, most places will do black and white by hand or in a rotary tube type machine or a dip and dunk if it's like a super big pro lab. But we actually have like a 1 hour photo style machine that does black and white, which I'm only aware of like one or two of these kinds of machines operating in the country. But it was such a game changer, because now, instead of black and white being something that had, you know, a certain amount of variation from batch to batch in terms of just, did we agitate for 30 seconds or 31 seconds? It's repeatable and consistent every time. I just think it's the coolest. We've got a Paycon scanner, a Noritsu scanner, two Fuji Frontier scanners. Oh, I got a car alarm outside. Sorry.
That's all right.
So, two Fuji Frontier scanners, a Creonite color paper processor that is, 31 inches wide. We've got, about 20 enlargers, all kinds of plumbing and electrical appliances. We've also got this whole software that is one of my babies. It's called Get My Lab Done Online. And it started as a custom like point of sale and file delivery system just for the darkroom. And it has now grown into its own separate business that I run. And we have a couple of other labs on it. But that's a blessing and a curse, because it makes everything so much more streamlined to have, you know, one computer system that knows everything that is specific to a photo lab, and we can track all of our stuff in one place. But then also it's like, oh, but could we make it do this? And could we make it do that? And can we make it talk to Slack? Can we make it talk to Dropbox? Can we make it talk to stamps.com? So it's really become a big project that's helped me really get a very practical introduction to computer programming by just kind of diving into a huge project. But I'm hoping it's going to be something that can kind of help out the photo lab industry for many years to come.
Man, I always forget about that because, you know, you said you had 300 rolls sitting waiting there to be processed and whatnot. Like, I can only imagine keeping track of everything that's going on.
Not even 300 rolls, 300 orders, which could have 12 rolls.
Oh, my goodness.
Oh,
yes.
Sure. Yeah.
Wow.
So our turnaround time is a couple extra days right now. But again, we're just absolutely thrilled that all of our customers are keeping us really busy and making like really, really incredible artwork. You know, like when we're developing and scanning the pictures, we don't snoop, but we can't help but take a glimpse. And it's always kind of an interesting way to have a little zeitgeist of the whole world and seeing how all of these different artists and image makers and people who are just starting and people who have been doing it for years, you see patterns and trends in terms of all of these thousands and thousands of photos in the aggregate. Yeah. It's a very cool job to be there scanning everyone's film and making sure it all looks nice.
So you had mentioned what's your official title?
I'm the technical director, which really encompasses everything from like plumbing and electrical repairs to pretty advanced troubleshooting and maintenance on, you know, machines from the 80s and 90s to, internet web programming stuff. So I'm very fortunate to have kind of showed up early on and had this incredible opportunity to, put my signature on a lot of different aspects of the darkroom. But I definitely really have to shout out Lucia Rallo, who's our executive director again. She's everything I do. She's putting in 10 hours for every hour that I put in, and I put in a lot of hours. She's an absolute powerhouse.
That's amazing. Yeah, because I think it was you. We were like repairing a machine on Instagram, right? Yeah. I was like, what?
I started making a whole series of me fixing the machines. Thankfully, everything's been working really
knock
well.
On
knock
wood.
On, knock on wood. So I haven't had to get my hands too dirty for the last couple of months. But you know, I'm sure now that I've said that. We're gonna have a circulation pump go out.
So, did you just pick that up by nature? Or did you train?
I'm what they call mechanically inclined.
Wow.
So, troubleshooting, I think, is a fine art, and I'm always trying to help people learn to be confident in their own ability to diagnose and repair problems. Because it's, I don't know, in a lot of ways, it's more of a mindset than a skill. You know, I always tell people nobody taught me how to fix a film processor or how to build a database. I just kind of, the way I think about it is I see a problem and I see, all of these tools that are available to me to solve problems and be like, all right, which tool do I need to use for this job and how do I apply it in the best way possible?
That's crazy.
Yeah, it's I don't know, a lot of reverse engineering, but I think kind of the secret to troubleshooting any kind of machine is you've got to follow the path. You've got to follow the trouble. So, you know, if you have a machine that's dealing with liquids and chemicals like our film processor, you know, you've got to follow the pipes and see where the fluid is getting stuck and why it's not getting to where it needs to go. And if you're repairing an electrical circuit, you know, it's the same thing. Electricity is a fluid and you want to follow the electricity and see where it needs to go and see what's preventing it from getting there.
And speaking of all that, I'm sitting here thinking about how with labs and, you know, I have a couple enlargers and stuff like that in my closet waiting to get set up again and start messing around with this stuff. Do you ever hear any like inklings of new equipment ever coming out, or are we just kind of stuck with what we got these days?
there's all kinds of really exciting stuff going on in the, you know, in the analog photography gadgetry world. I'm sure you guys are familiar with like the negative supply film film carriers.
Oh yeah.
Those those have been making a big buzz and for good reason, because I think they're really going to revolutionize the way we scan film. And it seems like they're up to a lot of other cool stuff. And then of course we've got, you know, there's other cool new products showing up every day. Like the Intrepid cameras and the Ars Imago lab box. These are all really revolutionary stuff. And I think there's a lot of different people that are innovating and finding ways that we can apply, you know, our 21st century conveniences, like rapid prototyping and like easier supply channels to get stuff manufactured offshore at a cheaper price and then import it back. You know, anyone can do that with a little bit of money and a couple of people with design skills, rather than it taking an entire office full of people that are doing your, you know, communicating with the factory and setting up the machine tooling and stuff. That's all become exponentially easier in recent years. There's a lot still to come, I think. Cool projects that I've that I've been keeping my eye on are the Schaefer linear processor. Is a fellow called Clyde Schaefer from Brooklyn is building a semi-automatic motion picture film processor, like a modular and open source design. That's something I've been following forever because it's really cool. Someday I hope to kind of take what he's done and find out if there's ways we can apply it to still photography, because you know, in terms of the way I see it, I think the future of film photography, I think there's always going to be a need and a market and a space for lab, for commercial work and you know, for people who don't want to make a mess in their house and deal with the chemicals. But I think as the industry continues to grow and change, and as it becomes easier and easier to do your own stuff at home with tools like the Labbox or the, you know, the fancy Cinestill sous vide that you can get for $40 if you just don't get the Cinestill one. You know, all of those things are making it so much more accessible for people to develop their own films. And we, you know, as much as we like people sending us their film, I think everyone ought to try doing it themselves at home.
I agree.
At least once.
Yeah.
Absolutely. I still have to tackle color film. Mm-hmm. Haven't done that yet.
You can do it. I believe in you. Whenever people ask me about developing their own color film, I tell them, you can do it. It's not that hard. You should try it once and you probably won't want to keep doing it.
Yeah.
But it's, you know, especially for people who aren't fortunate to, you know, live within walking distance or easy driving distance of a lab. It's really not that hard. But, you know, I got to say, now that I've got all access to all of these machines that are, you know, all of these machines are my babies, I never want to load another film reel again.
Right.
But, you know, it's definitely something I feel really fondly about.
So are you still in the trenches? Like, are you developing a bunch of film or are you just kind of more on the technical end of things?
It varies a lot week to week. So some weeks I'll be in the dark room, you know, 20 or 40 hours in the middle of the night tinkering with stuff. And sometimes I'll be there, you know, in the afternoon, like developing film and scanning it and stuff. Primarily, these days I'm doing a lot of our social media and answering the emails and helping people out with all of their questions, which is always a joy, although sometimes terrible. You know, we get the questions that we get are, you know, it's a really good mix. Like, you know, what kind of film stock should I select if I want to push it really far and, you know, try and stretch the limits, you know, or sometimes it's like, why are all my pictures that I took on a disposable camera without flash indoors at night coming out? So, you know, there's a lot of tact. I think the hardest part is, you know, we all, when we were getting into this, we all have done dumb things and had misunderstandings that caused us to do something wrong. And that can be really frustrating and difficult for someone who's new to the medium and new to the community. So we always feel like it's very important to, you know, help people figure out where and how they went wrong, and not be a jerk about it.
Yeah.
I feel like, I don't know, I feel like we get asked those questions a lot too on Instagram, just because we're you know, part of the community. It's fun though. I love that. I love, you know, any giving any sort of positive pushback into the community is a good thing, because God forbid if this would all go away someday, we'd be screwed.
I don't know. Yeah. What would I do?
I think
with
about
my
that
life
all the time. I'm just like, man, what if Kodak's like, we're shutting down next week, buy it while you can.
That does worry me a lot, and I've got my eye keeping a very close eye, or you know, as close an eye as I can through a telescope on Ferrania in northern Italy.
Yeah.
Which, you know, they seems like it's been hiccup after hiccup, but they haven't given up. And every time I'm like, no, it's been 6 months since the last update. Every time they've surprised me. So
yes,
I have faith in them, and I wish them all the best. And I've been loving P30, it's an absolutely gorgeous film.
It's beautiful.
You know, wouldn't bother me if I had to wait 5 more years for my Kickstarter release. I'm in it. How can I give you money? How can I give you more money?
Yeah. I'm waiting for them to come out with some color stocks. Then it's like, take all of my money. So I have a question for you, Caleb.
Sure.
What's the general like age range of people who come use the darkroom? Is it like mostly younger folks in college and stuff like that? Or is there some OGs coming through?
Yeah, we have like a really interesting and diverse base of people that are coming in. As you might expect, probably the majority of it is, I don't know, men aged 19 to 39. But we are doing everything that we can to, you know, broaden it a little bit. But even since the beginning, we've had people from all walks of life coming in. We get, you know, people from the real old school generation. Like we've had Buford Smith, who's a really, really interesting photographer from, you know, from the past, was a member for a long time and made a whole edition of prints.
That's awesome.
So we get, you know, I would say that our youngest customer has been maybe like 9 or 10 or 11. once in a while, we get a really precocious kid come in with their parent and I just absolutely love it because that was me.
Aww.
Like, Mom, can you please drive me to the camera store? I want to go buy a bag of Dettol.
I bet your parents were probably like, "What? How did we do? We created a monster. Look at."
Yeah. Well, they I'm sure they wonder all kinds of things about me, but you know, it's their fault for getting me interested in a hobby early and being kind and supportive throughout my upbringing. A lot of good that did them.
So, how many people work for the darkroom?
It varies a lot. So, you know, until recently, we had a large group of work exchange volunteers.
Oh, cool.
Doing most of the day to day for us. So it was a lot of students, a lot of recent graduates, and a lot of skateboarders and bicycle messengers and waiters and car repair people coming in like 3 or 4 hours a week, doing a shift developing and scanning film. In exchange for, you know, 3 or 4 hours a week of access to the lab time and film processors. So obviously we can't have that many people coming in and out during this pandemic.
Mm-hmm.
It sucks because it was so fun to be around and to have this avenue for people to get involved and to get access to the stuff they need to do their artwork without having to shell out the cash. So we're really sad that we've had to move to kind of a more standard model of having smaller number of paid technicians doing all of the work. And, you know, as things begin to reopen, we have some reassessing to do about what it's going to be in the future. But I would say the administrative core team of the darkroom, you know, the people that that make the tough decisions and coordinate all the logistics are myself, Lucia Rallo, executive director, Juliet Grodzins, operations manager, and Lacey Weathersby, who, she doesn't have it. We just gave her the job title VP of HR because we thought it would be funny. She was previously our volunteer coordinator, but she just does a little bit of everything. She's a fantastic person to have around.
It sounds like you had a great team. That's for sure.
Yeah, really. It's a good crew. I definitely miss having all of our work exchange volunteers there every day, but we're staying in touch.
It's got to be inspiring having all those people come in there, just like different walks of life. And that's such a cool idea, too.
It's fantastic. And I think it's been, you know, it's been a jumping off point for a lot of people to build their careers. We've had, you know, I think a lot of people have that as the first thing on their resume after college.
Yeah,
that's great.
A couple, you know, I think we've got a couple of very prolific street photographers that have been part of our fam for a while, like John Walker and Chris Voss and Brian Carlson and some other folks from the NYC Street Photography Collective.
Wow.
So you know, they're out there shooting like 20 rolls of film in a day. Yes. Out on the street. And it's all, you know, it's all incredible work, but the nature of street photography is you have to shoot a lot to be good at it. Mm-hmm. So I think being able to have, you know, more or less free access to film processing has been really helpful for a lot of up and coming artists who are shooting a lot but really can't afford to be spending hundreds and hundreds of dollars on film processing all the time. They, you know, they've found a really good way to give back in a alternative kind of method rather than just a cash-based economy.
God, when you're love pushing it out 20 rolls a walk.
Can you imagine?
The price
Jeez.
Of that. Jeez.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
That's such a great idea. I love that.
Mm-hmm. So, Caleb, how long did it take from when it was a small one room dark room to where it is now?
All right. So we opened up for the first time as a one room dark room, I think, mid late 2011. And then we, we moved up from the closet to the small storefront in 2012, 2013, kind of upgraded to a little bit of a larger space again in 2014. In 2015, we shut down for a couple of months and moved all this stuff and built out the new space. And we've been up and running on Troutman Street now for, I think, just about 5 years. Little more.
I love that.
That seems like no time. Like, if I can think of, time just flies so fast when
it really has flown quite a bit. And we're improving every day. But even compared to 2 or 3 years ago, we've really gotten to a much higher level of professionalism, like higher customer satisfaction, a lot more repeat customers, and certainly we've learned a lot of hard lessons and a lot of easy lessons too.
Man, that's just to think about it, that it started off like in a closet. I mean, Chris, you gotta get the ball rolling on your little dream here. I mean, even if you just rent out like a storage shed or something I think about it too, because like the closest dark room to me that I know about is the Nashville Community Dark Room, and I still think that's like not convenient at all for me. You know, like if I lived in the city, that would be super great. And everyone's like, well, why don't you start a dark room? It's just like, are you gonna front the dough? Because I'm sure it's gonna cost a couple bucks to get it together.
Especially, you know, if you have to buy a lot of equipment, it's a big startup cost. And kind of making everything customer proof is something that we've found to be the hardest, because you know, a lot of things that work in like an individual darkroom where it's only one or two or three people using it, you don't have to get the industrial grade of everything. There's definitely challenges associated with running a shared darkroom, but I think there's also benefits that you can't get anywhere else, because you know, when you're working in a shared darkroom, you can be in there printing with someone, and you know, you make new friends, you get advice both solicited and unsolicited. you get a sense of what other people's work is looking like, and you kind of absorb a little bit of everyone's style.
See, that's what I'm lacking. I need that like community aspect of it stinks. In this apartment that I'm at, we moved, I think, wow, it's been 5 years already. I think we've been living in this spot, but the last apartment we had was perfect. We had two bathrooms, so I could totally like man cave the other bathroom and turn it into a dark room. And I knew how everything was, and I didn't have to tear it down every time and put it back up. So just to have a spot where I could, even leaving the house too is a big deal. Like, cause I don't want to, you know, you get off of work, you get home, you eat dinner, you play with the cats. It's like time for TV and bed. And then, but when you have something like off, like in another location, it's just good to go there and get away and do stuff like that.
It is nice. We have a cat at the
Sweet. I love that.
His name is Chunks. Chunks. He's got his own Instagram account. It's Chunks_online.
Oh, great. I will be following that after this.
Yeah, it's right up your alley. Yeah, I think about my darkroom days. You know, it was under the stairs at my parents' house, where I would just like
very Harry Potter.
Yeah, very Harry Potter. That's the first time that's a really very good analogy. I like that. But I mean, we didn't have running water down there, so I would like develop with all those chemicals, like run upstairs, rinse it in the sink, and like I didn't know what it looked like until I came up from the basement to like take a look at it. You know?
Yeah, I guess I don't know. The thing that continually surprises me about analog is, you know, how badly you can mess things up in terms of, you know, the temperature and the quality control and the light leaks and stuff, and still get an image, how often some kind of technical mistake results in a piece of really interesting artwork. Even as we've kind of leveled up our quality control, and we do the control strips and the densitometers and the plotting, the charts and the graphs of the Dmax and the Dmin, it's definitely a big improvement in consistency to have all of that stuff, but it kind of just reinforces how incredible it is, the way that color film especially is truly the product of 150 years of research and development, and one of the most complex chemical things that you can purchase. It's really pretty amazing and pretty well designed.
It's all magic, man. It's just all magic.
Mm-hmm. No, it's science.
Yeah, you're right.
Damn. So do you have any, is there any future things in the works for the Bushwick Darkroom?
There's always future things in the works. We're opening within like the next 2 or 3 years. We'll be making some moves on our next location, next expansion. We absolutely love where we are now, but believe it or not, we're running out of space.
Wow.
And the building that we have is great, but we don't own it. We don't have excellent relations with our landlord. And the structure itself isn't in the best condition. So we're waiting for our unicorn warehouse to come along that'll give us a 20-year lease, and it'll have air conditioning.
Ooh.
That's great. Really what we need. We made a big improvement last year installing air conditioning in our production office where we keep all the customer film and all the scanners and stuff. But just the space itself is too big to ever be really fully temperature controlled. So it's cold in the winter and it's hot in the summer, but I don't know. I guess in a certain way, that's part of the fun. The black and white darkroom is also air conditioned.
Oh, that's good.
We'll be right back with a listener question right after this message from our sponsor.
Support for Analog Talk comes from Polaroid. Use the promo code ANALOGTALK10 on your first purchase on film at Polaroid.com.
All right, guys, this is a part of the show where we break off and take a question from one of our listeners. And this week's question comes from Dean Scutt. And he wanted to know, what do you think about the environmental impact of film? Not just chemicals, but film packaging. I like this.
Yeah, I absolutely love this question because I think there's a lot of different things that go into the answer. In terms of stuff that is imminent threats to our ecosystem and our world, just in terms of magnitude, I don't think analog photography ranks too highly on that list. But that's not to say that we don't need to be doing everything we possibly can to sort of minimize the impact. The chemical question, is one that's been asked for a long time. The modern processes are fairly efficient in terms of how much of it can be recycled and what the best practices are for disposing it. So all of our chemistry goes through silver recovery. We have an amazing local company right here in Brooklyn called Graymark that does silver recovery services. So they've got this amazing little old man who comes in and cleans out our silver recovery unit every couple of months. So we love them, and we love that there's still, a place that that does kind of full service with that, because it's still in use in a lot of industrial things. But in terms of like the packaging, I think it never ceases to amaze me how inefficiently film is packaged. I don't know why Kodak, Ilford, and Fuji and Ferrania and everyone else is still doing it this way. Like, the 120 film has those little flexible foil wrappings. I'd like to see that on 35mm film. I'm not sure if there's any technical constraints. I do love a good film canister, but I think it's a lot of plastic that's being wasted needlessly. Same thing with the cardboard box. I think this stuff persists because people are used to it and because the production lines are already set up that way. But I think that it is something I would really like to see the big companies look into as a way to both lessen their production costs over time and to contribute a little less to their carbon footprint and their trash footprint.
Yeah, shout out to Lomography. Their Metropolis is a reusable canister.
Yeah, it's like a plastic canister.
Yeah. Oh, interesting. I'm surprised actually that they're putting into those are very expensive. One thing, if anyone is reloading their own film and you need a bunch of empty 35mm cassettes, contact us or like almost any other lab, because we have to recycle boxes and boxes and boxes of them all the time. Show up and we can give you a few for free or a whole ton of them for very cheap.
Yeah, I often think about just I got a 10-pack of Tri-X or something not too long ago, and just like shucking everything, like the box, the canister. And it's like, I use the can, like you can only reuse canisters for so many things. I got screws and bolts and tacks and keep my vitamins in some, and like, it's just, I definitely try to use them as much as possible. But Yeah, it's a lot of waste. I didn't even think about it until reading that question. It's nuts.
Well, that, yeah, that was
very
a good answer.
Very yeah. good answer. We can go to the second half of the listener interaction, and this is the Desert Island Camera. We didn't really get to talk much about your photography, but this is yeah. a good way to get into it.
Yeah.
So we have the island, and on the island there is a lab and all the film you could possibly ever want. So if you could only choose one camera, your Desert Island baby, what's it going
to
be?
All right. So I guess I've got two ways to answer this question. So if it was a desert island where I'm the only one there and I've got plenty of time and really all there is to do is landscape photography or maybe self-portraits, I would totally go for a large format camera, the largest
Ooh.
That's available. And I would want to be shooting, I think... I don't know. I would maybe want to be shooting transparencies in it.
Really?
Give me a big box of Velvia and a Deerdorf 8x10 for the desert island. But if I was, I wouldn't say that's my number one choice for general purpose photography or even my most favorite camera. I would say that my favorite camera that I actually own is a Bronica SQ.
Oh, I love that camera.
The Japanese Hasselblad,
mm-hmm.
and I'm also very fond of my Kiev 88, which is the Soviet Hasselblad, the Hasselbladsky. I've also been really enjoying like my smaller 35 millimeter cameras recently. I've got a Yashica T4 Zoom, which is like a little point and shoot, and a Pentax ME Super, which, you know, it's a mediocre camera from the late 70s. It's sort of a prosumer camera from that time, if you will. But for some reason, it feels so nice in my hand. It's smaller than a K1000. It fits in your pocket, but you get all that nice Pentax glass, and it's got a decent like aperture priority auto exposure. I bought my first one when I was like 15 at a yard sale for $10, and I've gone through like, I don't know, at least three or four of them since then. cute little thing.
I love that about when you kind of find your camera, you know, like for the longest time I was a big like Canon FTB, a mm-hmm. diehard with that camera. And it's if you just, you know, you stick with something, you shoot it long enough, you of course it's nice to have, you know, the fancy stuff, but it's not very important.
Mm-hmm. How do you like the T4 Zoom? It's one I don't own and I want.
I am a big fan of it. It's so convenient. It's got a fantastic lens and like a decent light meter. There are like some things about it that are very, very annoying. Like it doesn't have, you can't manually set the ISO. There's only like one option for exposure compensation, but it does exactly what I needed to where and when I want to bring it.
So speaking of, we didn't get into your photography, what kind of stuff do you like to shoot?
So I have a very limited range of things that I actually shoot. I've been working on the same project for 8.5 years. Mm. Since I was a freshman photo major wow. at NYU, I got assigned this project in Wafa Bilal's freshman digital photography class to, you know, go out and spend a couple weeks doing a documentary project. And it was right before spring break. So I went home to the little village in Carversville, Pennsylvania that I came from. And I was curious about this place that I had heard of. There was, a two or three hour drive away. It's a town in Pennsylvania with an underground fire where all the people had abandoned
Centralia.
It.
Centralia.
It's called Centralia. Yep, yep, yeah. Yep. So it's very famous. So I went out there and I started photographing it. And I realized that, you know, Centralia is kind of cool and interesting and spooky, but that whole coal mining region around it is just fascinating and beautiful and sad and complicated. So I've been returning to that part of northeastern Pennsylvania, like Scranton, Hazleton, Monoy City, Ashland, Jim Thorpe, other small towns and cities and rural areas out there a couple of times a year now for almost a decade. It's been totally fascinating to watch it change, especially how things changed in the fall of 2016. I have family history out in that area from kind of the turn of the last century, which I've been exploring and sort of asking the question of, you know, what if they never left? What if I was me, like, a curious gay industrial photographer? What if I was growing up in northeastern post-industrial Pennsylvania rather than the very different Pennsylvania community that I grew up in 100 miles away. And it's been a real education in empathy and an education in politics and American history. And I guess the point that I want to make with the images that I take there are that it's important not to disregard your industrial and commercial history and technical history. And it's important not to disregard your brothers and sisters and neighbors a little further inland, especially sort of in a political sense. I think there's a big rush to judgment towards coal miners and red counties and, you know, and the hats and the yard signs and stuff. People out there are not crazy and they're not stupid. They're rational people reacting appropriately to conditions that have been imposed on them. And you know, the people out there who are angry at regulations that make it more difficult to mine their coal, you know, they're not just like, I want to dump chemicals in this creek just for the fun of it. They're like, I'm trying to feed my family, and this is the only way that I physically can do that.
Right.
So I think a lot of our national conversation about this kind of thing is one-dimensional in a lot of ways, and it lacks depth, and it lacks empathy, and it lacks historical context.
So are there any plans to do like a book of this project? Eight years is a long time.
I'm just kind of continuing to, you know, slowly work on it here and there as I get time. I don't know what the eventual destination of it is going to be, but I think it's got to be a book or a documentary or some kind of like complicated multimedia thing. But I guess I like the idea of making it sort of a project that functions as a part of its own archive. In general, I sort of think of myself as a person who will often favor quantity over quality. And there are other photographers who are going out to the same towns and the same coal mines that I am. For example, Andrew Wirtz and Joel Anderson are doing, you know, incredibly beautiful and haunting and moving portraiture. And I think my approach is a little different. I don't know. I talk to people whenever I can, but it's not so focused and important to me to really form deep personal connections with individual people so much as it is to capture a real breadth of this area and this region and the local economy almost as a time capsule of what things are like in the first quarter of the 21st century in the Pennsylvania anthracite coal country.
Wow.
It's so wild to think, because I'm originally from central Pennsylvania. It's where I grew up and spent my entire life basically until I moved here. And when I was in elementary school, this is forever ago, mind you, we used to go to coal mines on school field trips. Like that was a thing that we would go. Mm-hmm. I mean, they wouldn't take you like, you know, miles deep into it or anything. We weren't like lighting dynamite or anything, but it was, it's like such a big part.
Oh yeah. The mine tour is a seminal experience for any Pennsylvania kid.
Yeah.
And you know, if you're ever passing through, Pennsylvania, it's actually, or any coal mining region, I would say going on a mine tour, even if it's a tourist trap, is something that's fascinating. Yeah. You really can learn a lot, and it's just kind of cool. I like tunnels. Very attractive about going underground.
It's just wild to think, because I just, you saying that, you know, politics has gotten so out of hand and in the last couple years with the hate on both sides, and it's a real shame that it's getting so divided. But even seeing like why I left from where I'm from is just, it's a dead town, you know what I mean, from not having any jobs anymore. It was a steel town, it was a coal town, it was an everything, you know, like
which town did you come from?
Lebanon, Pennsylvania.
Lebanon. All right. Is that east or west of State College?
It's south, actually. South.
Okay.
Southeast, I think, from State College.
Cool. Yeah, I'm familiar. Beautiful area, but yeah, it's
yeah, it's just wild how things have changed so much.
It's a great state.
Yeah, love it. So yeah, okay. Well, we have one last question on the whole camera side of things, and it's the white whale camera. Is there anything out there that you've kind of had your eye on that never had a chance to like shoot or buy or?
Oh boy, is there ever?
Yeah.
I Let's see. Yeah, I was shit talking Hasselblad earlier, but I really want one of those Hasselblad super wides. That's just, it's just the lens glued to a film back. It's so cool.
Oh yeah, I know what you mean. Yeah.
It's a really weird, unusual looking camera. And I've also been the Cynar Handy is sort of a similar idea in 4x5. I recently got into approaching things with a wide angle rather than a normal lens, and I've been enjoying that. I want a Hasselblad X Pan.
Oh, you and me both, man.
Mm-hmm.
Oh.
Which is not, it's, you know, it's not a true Hasselblad, although I guess it is Swedish. and I guess the last thing is getting a little deeper into 16mm filmmaking. I have a Krasnogorsk, and I've done a little bit of 16mm shooting, but I think I'd like to try out something that can shoot more than 100 feet at a time and maybe do some sync sound. But I think I still have a lot to learn in the cinema department before I'm ready to make that kind of an investment.
Yeah.
Are you making like short films, or what are you doing with
that? I'm just kind of shooting. Like when I've been going out to cold country, I've been shooting a little bit of motion picture film each time. Never really anything narrative. And because, you know, with a wind up camera that can't sync sound, it's hard to, it's hard to do a documentary or anything like that. So for now, it's just sort of like little slices and moments. I've been wanting to try making some kind of looping projector setup.
Oh, cool.
With some of the footage from that.
Very cool.
Mm-hmm. Well, I guess we'll get that at the end. I was just going to ask if you had a personal account. I'd love to see these Pennsylvania pictures.
Sure thing.
I miss home. Man, great.
Well, Caleb, this has been great. Thank you so much for letting us pick your brain about all things community darkroom. And it's really awesome that Bushwick is doing such amazing things, especially for the community in this crazy times that we're in. So thank you for that.
Yeah, it's been so great talking to you. If you're ever in New York, absolutely hit us up. For all you wonderful listeners out there, congratulations on making it to the end. If you want to get some more information about the darkroom, we're on Instagram as Bushwick DKRM. It's BUSHWICK DKRM. And my personal account is Caleb Savage Photo.
Awesome. Timothy, where are you at online?
Guys, you can find me on Instagram. It's at Timothy Makeups. I also make film photography related YouTube videos. Easiest way to find that is to go to the search bar. Just search Timothy Makeups. You'll find a bunch of stuff there. Chris, where are you?
So I am Chris B. Photo on Instagram, Twitter, and YouTube. We're Analog Talk Pod on Twitter, Analog Talk Podcast on Instagram. And we have a Facebook page and a group you can join and share photos and talk to each other and all that stuff. So that's it.
Yay.
Thank you, Caleb. Thank you. This is awesome.
Thank you.
All right, guys. We'll see you next time. Bye.
All right, guys. First off, we want to thank Caleb for coming on the show and giving us the deets of the Bushwick community darkroom. Can't wait to make it up to NYC and hang out there, make some prints, develop some film. Thanks, Caleb, for coming on the show. Guys, that's going to take us to Patreon. Head over to patreon.com/analogtalk. We have a bunch of stuff over there. We also put out the show 2 days early. You can get that for just $1. We're also doing Patreon exclusive after shows and just Patreon specials. So head over there, check it out. There's a bunch of stuff. And thanks to all the patrons who already support the show. Guys, we don't know what we would do without you. And until next week, we'll see you soon. Later.
As humans, we're naturally driven by the search for better. But when it comes to hiring, the best way to search for a candidate isn't to search at all. Don't search, match with Indeed. When I was looking to hire someone, it was so slow and overwhelming. I wish I had used Indeed. If you need to hire, you need Indeed. Indeed is your matching and hiring platform, with over 350 million global monthly visitors according to Indeed data, and a matching engine that helps you find quality candidates fast. Ditch the busy work. Use Indeed for scheduling, screening, and messaging so you can connect with candidates faster. And Indeed doesn't just help you hire faster. 93% of employers agree Indeed delivers the highest quality matches compared to other job sites, according to a recent Indeed survey. And listeners of this show will get a $75 sponsored job credit to get your jobs more visibility at Indeed.com/podcast. That's Indeed.com/podcast. Terms and conditions apply. As humans, we're naturally driven by the search for better. But when it comes to hiring, the best way to search for a candidate isn't to search at all. Don't search, match with Indeed. When I was looking to hire someone, it was so slow and overwhelming. I wish I had used Indeed. If you need to hire, you need Indeed. Indeed is your matching and hiring platform, with over 350 million global monthly visitors according to Indeed data, and a matching engine that helps you find quality candidates fast. Ditch the busy work. Use Indeed for scheduling, screening, and messaging so you can connect with candidates faster. And Indeed doesn't just help you hire faster. 93% of employers agree Indeed delivers the highest quality matches compared to other job sites, according to a recent Indeed survey. And listeners of this show will get a $75 sponsored job credit to get your jobs more visibility at Indeed.com/podcast. That's Indeed.com/podcast. Terms and conditions apply.